الله أكبر الله أكبر.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the Islamic Center at New York University podcast, coming to you straight from the heart of New York City. We're building an amazing Muslim community here at ICNYU, where everyone is welcomed and respected no matter where you're from or where you're at. This is the place to be. So open your ears and your heart and come along with us on another life-changing journey. Bismillah.
Bismillah, walhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam ala rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. All praise is due to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We thank Him, we praise Him, we glorify Him, we beseech Him to send His choicest salutations upon His most beloved sallallahu ta'ala alayhi wa sallam, upon all those who choose to tread in His path until the last day. So on Friday, I gave a khutbah here at the IC. We've been looking at verses from Surah Al-Furqan that talk about a group of people called the Ibad al-Rahman, the servants of Allah, who are categorized in relationship to His divine name of Ar-Rahman. And we can talk about that in a little bit, but we went through about a dozen different characteristics of these individuals outlined in the Quran and Surah Al-Furqan. And the last verse that describes them says, وَالَّذِينَ يَقُولُونَ رَبَّنَا هَبْلَنَا مِنْ أَزْوَاجِنَا وَذُرِيَاتِنَا قُرَّةَ عَيُّنْ وَجَعَلْنَا لِلْمُتَّقِينَ إِمَامًا. That they're the ones that make dua to Allah that, oh Allah, bless me or give to me the coolness of my eyes from our spouses, our children, and make us from the leaders of the Muttaqeen, right? May Allah make us from amongst them. And so what became really clear after that was a good number of people after Jummah. Who was here at Jummah last Friday? Oh, wow. A good number of people. I usually get people who will email, who will call, who will reach out about various things. But there was a lot of people that reached out and they said that in the context of what the khutbah was, the idea was aspirationally to have a family setting that was rooted in this, right? To give you just a breakdown, not to go through it again, you can find it online, the khutbah. But the dua it says, Rabbana hablana. So our Lord, right? We make dua in the Quran. There's this idea that we're making dua for all of us. You know, it's not necessarily just me making dua for myself, but the Rabbana, the na is denoting like a sense of just communal understanding. Hablana, right? In Arabic, when you say to give, you can use the word ata, you can use the word ita, and these mean to give and gift in certain ways. And there's distinctions made that one is about giving things that are material and others are immaterial, right? Like we say, Rabbana atina fid dunya hasana wa fil akhirati hasana, right? Wa kina adhab an-nar. You're asking for something to be given in that sense. Hablana is rooted etymologically in the same root as the word for gift in Arabic, hiba. Is anybody named hiba here? You have friends named hiba, right? So hiba is a gift. And so hablana is a giving that recognizes this as like a gift. That's the sense of what the word means. The qurra ta'ayun, right? The word qurra in Arabic, it has the same root as the word for something that's chilly or cold or cooling, right? And your ayn is your eye. So the idea in a Meccan society from this dua is twofold, because this chapter, Surah Al-Furqan, is a Meccan surah. And the distinction between verses that are Meccan and Medinese is not that they're revealed in Mecca and Medina, but Meccan surahs verses are those that take place before the hijra of people going from Mecca to Medina, where there's the establishment now of a Muslim community, a place to inject now legal injunctions and all of this stuff that you can't do when you're living as the minority, right? And so in the Meccan chapters, this is before they've established a community. So what's happening in the early years of Revelation? These verses are coming down to a population that all of them are converts to Islam, right? Nobody is born into Islam when Islam is first revealed. Everybody's converting into it. That makes sense? So the verse is giving indications about fundamental ethics and certain ethoses that Islam is built upon. But you have these people that are being told to make dua, who many of them are likely the only Muslim in their family. And they're making dua to Allah that, ya Allah, give me the gift of a coolness of my eyes that stems from my families, these relationships that I have, these most immediate relationships. And then there's nothing without meaning in Allah's book for all of us, right? So it's not that a verse gets contextualized and it's, well, it was only applicable 14 centuries ago, but it still means something to me. So the notion is there that all of us make this dua. Like, give me this gift that when I come now upon my family, these relations, they serve as this coolness. And again, you contextualize in the Meccan Arabia that is super hot. It's not just a joke. It's desert climate. There's not a lot going on there, right? I went for Umrah in the first week of June. And the temperature was getting at that point in June up to like 110 degrees. It was really hot. You can conceptualize what the situation is by comparing it. If you were in New York City over the last 3 weeks, we had heat waves going on, right? It's miserable. It's humid. It's sticky. And so the idea of coolness in that sense and coolness being a comfort, you want to experience it in terms of what's real, right? And this is a principle, not as a tangent, but as a principle to being able to understand things that are Quranic, that are metaphysical, you relate them to your day-to-day experience. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's hard at times for us to understand the love of God, but you can understand the love of God by understanding the love that you have amongst, like, God's creation, right? So I see the love my wife has for our children, and it just gives me an insight into a God that loves me more than a mother loves his child, right? Or the love that I feel from my daughter and my son that is remarkable, you know what I mean? Can serve as an inroad to then start to fathom what does it mean to have love of God or love for God, right? And so think, if you were here when it hit the real field temperature in Manhattan, where everything is pavement and the heat's bouncing off the street, and bottles of water sometimes are sold for $7, right? How hot was it when it felt like it was 105 degrees in the middle of Manhattan? And so comfort and coolness is very different when you're talking about that as your regular interaction. Give me that sense of comfort that can only come from like a refreshing glass of water at the end of a long day of fast, that you don't want anything other than to just soothe that thirst. That's what that coolness aspect is referring to. And when it is paired with the eye now, qurrata'ayun, it says, right? The example I gave in the khutbah on Friday was of my son, who just turned 7, mashallah, and he and I went to play basketball at a court near our apartment, the Asser Levy Park, if you've been near the FDR and 23rd Street. We're playing outdoors. He's a little kid, and it's really interesting to see little kids experience things for the first time in their lives ever. Mm-hmm. So we're playing, we're laughing, we're running around, we're joking, and then all of a sudden everything stops. My son got something in his eye. And he's now, at that point, almost 7, he's 6. And this thing is in his eye, and there's no way that he knows how to get it out of his eye because he's never gotten anything in his eye before. And so he's fiddling with his eye. He's like blinking. He's rubbing on it. He doesn't know what to do. We have water bottles. We pour the water into his eye. He's still trying to like get it adjusted. He tries to play a little bit, but then he doesn't play. And then after about 6-7 minutes, he says, Baba, I just want to go home. Mm-hmm. And I said, are you sure? Because he's having a lot of fun. And he said, yeah, let's just go home. Now we're taking steps out of the court, walking through a playground, getting to this turf. And then all of a sudden, he gets super excited. And he says, it's out of my eye, Baba. And I said, do you want to still go home? And he said, no, I want to stay. The idea of the relief that he felt in that moment, after just the difficulty of dealing with something that's so fragile, like your eye, that's what this dua is saying. They give me the gift of feeling that comfort in my perception when I see my family, when I see the people who I have close relationships with. I want that as a gift. رَبَّنَا هَبْلَنَا مِنْ أَزْوَاجِنَا وَذُرِيَاتِنَا قُرَّةَ عَيْنٍ. That, oh Allah, give me this gift, a coolness in my eye. I want to feel a comfort the way it feels like I got gook in my eye. I got eyelashes in my eye. I got something that's making me freak out because I don't know how to deal with the fragility that is this eye on my face and it getting messed up. Let me feel the elation that someone feels when they no longer have that pain, but they have that comfort and sense, that sense of relief. I want to feel that every time I walk into my house and I come upon the people that are there. I walk into my community setting and I'm sitting now with my sisters and brothers. Give me the gift of feeling relief by seeing certain people that I have relationships with. Does that make sense? That was the dua that we were talking about as the last characteristic of the Ibad al-Rahman. They make this dua. And it's a really crazy dua to reflect on in the context of all the other things that are being described of the Ibad al-Rahman. And you should go read those verses because Allah gives us like a handful of lists in the Quran that are achievable. They're not given so that we're self-deprecating, but you have aspiration to say, these are the characteristics and qualities that I want to aspire towards. And so you're in this space and we can unpack it more. But the notion that is, give this to me as a gift, it also then by principles of logic assumes that some of these relationships are not gifts for us. Some are very difficult. Some can be very trying. They can have a lot of tribulation to them, a lot of hardship, a lot of challenges. And many of us have experienced these, or we know people who have experienced these types of things. Tonight, we're not going to be talking about relationships in the sense of abuse. May Allah protect us from it and protect us from ever becoming those who abuse any other individuals. But we want to talk about it not in that sense, which I'm not going to tell you that's the rarity. I'm not going to tell you that those are outliers, because I've seen a lot of people go through a lot of traumatic things. We don't want to undermine them. But we want to think about relationships that are not in the category of abuse and think about our day-to-day relationships. Because what becomes evident is that a lot of us carry a lot of hurt inside. A lot of us allow for others to carry a lot of hurt inside. And we don't fundamentally reflect on some of what exists in our tradition that talks about what the actual challenge is that bears itself within when we give now abode to our hearts, feelings of resentment, bitterness, unreconciled anger, envy, jealousy. May Allah protect us from these things. And so it's not just about the other, but also within yourself. You don't want to carry that kind of stuff inside of you. Does that make sense? I want to take a quick pause. What do you think so far? What does it bring up for you? What are some of your thoughts? You just turn to the person next to you and just speak to them about what we've said so far, what I've said so far, what it's giving rise to, and then we'll come back and kind of go through a couple of things. Yeah, just turn to the people next to you in pairs. So not in like groups of 17. but in pairs. Just talk to the people. There's an odd number of people, and you have a group of three.
When they pass by, like bigger people, they like walk the I wonder where that is. Why that means it. They start out how they
And also the family has the potential to kind of like get on your nerves because there's things. So like if you master yourself with your family, and like I feel like everybody inside your household, it's more
protected. Yeah.
Right? And then like if somebody really doesn't know, you always know you have somebody. I never thought of that. Like, why I'm going to put that inside. Once more about how we think about certain things, but that's why specifically about like some of like my giving us.
Okay, so what are some of the things that are coming up for people right now? What did you talk about in your group? Who wants to start?
You can start.
Yeah, go for it.
So we discussed how like the Dua, Rabbana Hablana Minaz Rajana, there's like a strategic purpose to why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put it in that surah after talking about like how we can show up. But that dua is more about Allah giving to us. So we were talking about like why or what is the like what is the meaning behind that. We don't have like a conclusion. We were just discussing.
Great. What else? Yeah, go ahead.
I think we discussed about how I think we were similar in the aspect, like we grew up saying, like hearing the fact that, oh, God loves you more than your mother. But at the same time, you know, growing up with immigrant parents where they were like, if you do this, God's going to be angry if you do that. So understanding growing up and looking back and understanding the dua now makes a lot more sense, because understanding the way your relationship with your mom and how that affected your relationship with God. And how now that you understand her, like the things she went through and the struggle she went through and what she became, the understanding where she's coming from, now makes it more open to what God is and your love towards God is it changed as we grew. So that's what we found.
Great. Other thoughts? Maybe one or two more people. You want to say it, Lemon?
I'm sorry. I'm just going to really look at you and smile.
Makes me smile back at you.
A lot of people say that I'm going to be very comfortable and very interested in their lives. But in my case, I just feel like it's kind of stuff. We can't really change how other people think of it. I mean, I love like reconnect or rebuild bonds, but like, if for other people, if your other family members aren't doing the same thing or run through that reciprocity, the reciprocating. And it becomes difficult. Like, especially post Ramadan or during all of that, in my vision.
Definitely, yeah. Anyone else? One last person? Yeah.
I wasn't here for the first portion, but Lena gave me an overview of what you guys discussed. And I think a big thing that comes up for me is boundaries. And you can have such a strong bond that you lose boundaries, and that's something that we're not taught how to create. We're not taught how to create healthy ones. And I think with our parents being from a completely different world, and like as much as they assimilate, it doesn't mean that they change their mindset, and it doesn't mean that they learn the things that like what we're learning. For those of us who go to therapy, it's not like our parents are doing the same amount of work. They're just not. So it's like we're hitting a wall. But anyways, what it brings up for me is like the enmeshment theory and how important boundaries are in building a bond, because it can go too far. You know, even good can go too far, you know? So that's how I feel.
So we want to be able to start to create boundaries. We want to be able to understand ourselves through some of these things. Because fundamentally, you're going to live in this world and your existence is going to have you relate to others, and we'll have others relate to you in some capacity. And those building blocks of our own individual growth is going to necessitate in some way, shape, or form that we are not going to live in isolation. We're going to come into interaction with people that we either have deep bonds with, we have very tangential, cursory relationships with. We want to be able to know what to do when something doesn't go so well, right? And what is the impact back to me as well as the impact back to the other? Because ours is a tradition that does not exist purely in the prism of externals. So it's not just that I feel something and it impacts what's going on around me. What can manifest itself can give deep insight on what's going on inside of me. But the deeper rooted impact goes within. And it's a struggle. It's not easy. And the ability to harness is something that can then have residual impact that is yielding a lot of benefit, both in this world and in the next, right? There's a story in our, you know, tradition. Anas ibn Malik was known as the Khadim of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He's a young boy who spent a lot of time with the Messenger of God. And so he narrates this hadith where he is with the Prophet and people in Medina. And the Prophet, many of you probably heard this hadith, is with them. And amongst them is another companion by the name of Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As. And the Prophet says to the people that are gathered, do you want to see somebody who is a person of Jannah? A person in paradise? And they say, yeah, of course we want to see something like that. And so their anticipation is that the individual that's going to come forth, somebody who's well known, a person of, you know, kind of outstanding reputation, then somebody comes who is just an everyday unsaudi person. He's got like a fresh wudu, a sign indicating he just washed up for prayer. And the next day, the Prophet says the same thing. The same person passes. The third day, the Prophet says the same thing. And the same person passes. Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As, he wants to know what's making this person so unique that the Prophet has now thrice said, this is a person of Jannah. And so he says to this man, you know, I'm having a quarrel with my father. Can I come stay in your home? And he's given permission to stay there for 3 days. He stays and 3 nights, sleeps in this person's house. And what's really important to note is that the companion doesn't dig deeper into it. What was the fight about with your dad? You know, tell me your business. He's just asked, can I stay in your home? He says, you can stay in my house. And after observing him for 3 days, 3 nights, he says, there's nothing unique as such that this person does. And so on the third day's conclusion, he says, look, I'm not fighting with my father. I stayed here to be able to understand, why did the messenger of God say that you are a person of Jannah? He tells him the situation. This is what comes up. And the Ansari man says, I have no idea. I'm just what you see I am. And then as Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As is getting ready to go, the man says to him that what I do regularly every night before I go to bed is I make sure that I'm not holding anything in my heart against anybody. And I free my heart from any bitterness, resentment towards anyone. And Abdullah radiallahu anhumah, he says that this is why you are a person of Jannah, and this is what we're incapable of. It's not meant to be an idealistic narrative, but you want to trickle it down now to human development. It's very natural that somebody wrongs you, that you have resentment. Nothing that we experience emotionally in and of itself is good or bad. Allah is the one that gave you all of your emotions in the first place. They all have meaning and purpose to it. The way that we respond to emotions can be categorically good or bad. What we associate quite often with good, bad emotions can also be a very simplistic analysis through a prism of emotional intelligence. Because if feeling joy is good, but I feel joy at your misery, then that's not a good thing. If feeling anger is bad, but you're not angry at injustice, oppression, you hear about Black people getting shot in the streets, you hear about children getting locked up in cages at our borders, you hear about all kinds of gross inequities, and it doesn't get you upset, probably a problem. So fundamentally, what we can categorize as good and bad is not the emotion itself, but the act that corresponds to the emotion. What is it bringing me towards? Resentment has a positive to it because resentment gives you an understanding of your moral compass. You need to be able to recognize when somebody is actually wronging you. And you can say, well, isn't that an obvious thing? From the outside looking in, you might be able to say, why does that person let that person treat them in that way? But when you're immersed in it, you're stuck in it. The people you're trying to make sense of mistreating you are those that you've had spent years of dissonance trying to validate why somebody who cares about you treats you in this way. Because nobody goes into a relationship or becomes conscious of a relationship with the assumption that my friend actually hurts me. My father does not treat me right. So resentment in and of itself is not a bad thing to feel. You get what I'm saying? Because you need to have a level of awareness rooted in your moral compass. It's not a moral relativism, but you're able to stand and say, it's not okay that you do this to me. But now if that feeling stays with you, it's now not just something that you experience in the moment, but it's something that you hold on to forever. Not by your choice, you didn't put it there, but it's still now there within you. It's going to have a toxic impact because it has the capacity now to bear the likeness of something that is acidic. The resentment in and of itself is a deep challenge And if you have anything that bears the properties of something that is acidic, it's not hurting what it is that's around it, but it's hurting what it is that is encompassing it. It's going to just deteriorate the vessel that's holding onto it. And the positioning of emotions in our tradition, your spiritual heart has multiple layers to it, right? So you have the sadar, that's the outermost layer of the heart, right? Right? Are people with me? Do you get what I'm saying? So you have your heart, right? So we have the sadr, like we say, Rabbi shrahli sadri, right? Musa alayhi salam makes the dua that, oh Allah, expand for me my chest. You know, he's not talking about his physical chest, right? Or we say in the last chapters of the Quran, right? Alladhi yuwaswisu fi sudurin nas, that shaitan whispers into the sadr of your being, right? It's the outermost layer of your heart. Yeah, the spiritual heart has the other layers, the qalb. You have what's called the fu'ad, and you have what's called the lub. We're not going to go into all of it, but the fu'ad essentially becomes the seat of emotions, right? So in the Quranic narrative of Musa alayhi salam, when Moses' mother is described as she is letting go of her infant child, the anxiety she feels is associated with her fu'ad. So when you're giving resentment now, not a temporary abode, but a more permanent abode, it's sitting within a layer of your spiritual heart. Does it make sense? And if it stays there for so long, this companion is seen as a person of paradise. And he says, this is what I do regularly. We'll talk about in a minute steps to it. So it's not just ambiguous. But he's addressing actual things. He doesn't say, I don't feel it. He doesn't say, I don't get upset. I never have anger. He says, I don't hold on to things. I don't let it just sit with me. I don't keep it there. And that's not for the sake of the other. Forgiveness is not for the one being forgiven, but forgiveness is for the forgiver. And so we want to be able to extrapolate, because now this person, all of him is connected to the rest of him. And a heart now that carries unrelenting resentment and bitterness is going to find its presence in other decisions and in other actions and in other choices. And then it'll have consequential presence in what's going on. So you wake up the next week, it's still sitting in there. And your deeds are going to be reflected through its presence. You let it go, it's not present now in how you decide what I'm going to do the next day, the day after. And so the culmination of it is resulting in a person who's able to feel freedom inside, not suffocation, is not imprisoned within themselves. And then the end result is that person's a person of paradise, because the heart is seeing the world in a different way. Do you get what I mean? The other ways we want to think about this is rooted in now how we, as a principle in our relationship with God, that there is a variable of how we relate to others impacting how we relate to the divine. You can't have this conversation in a way that's devoid of reality. So understand the principle objectively. Don't jump to mesh it into your life. Because just like that verse we just said, الَّذِي يُوَسْوِسُ فِي صُدُورِ النَّاسِ, shaitan's going to get you where you're most vulnerable. Not where I'm most vulnerable. It's going to get you where things stick with you. So if you have some difficult relationships, you're going to try to get to that in the crux of this conversation, but you don't want to seek to employ a mindset that, again, barring situations of abuse, two people create a dynamic. And that dissonance is going to have us at times take on a lot more blame than we necessarily need to, or have us get pushed back to memories that are infused with hard conversations, arguments, quarrels, irreconciled emotion That's not what the point of this is. So the ways that we know that these things impact our relationship with Allah. You've likely heard a lot of hadith that are like this. We have hadith, for example, that says, he who is not thankful of people is not thankful of the divine, right? That if you don't thank or show gratitude to others, then you're not showing gratitude to Allah. You have hadith that say very clearly, people are harsh with others, Allah will be harsh with them. One of the first hadith we're taught in any majlis is called the hadith ar-rahma, the tradition of mercy. It says, ar-rahimuna yarhamukum ar-rahman, irhamu man fil ardh, yarhamkum man fis sama, that the merciful one is merciful to those who are merciful. Be merciful on the earth, the one who is in the heavens will be merciful to you. Irhamu man fil ardh, yarhamkum man fis sama. There's a relationship there, right? In another hadith, Jabir ibn Abdullah radiallahu anhu, he says that Allah is not merciful to those who are not merciful to mankind. We can keep going on and on and on, right? Son of Adam comes to Allah on the day of judgment. Allah says that, why did you not feed me when I was hungry? Visit me when I'm sick. Give me drink. He says, you are Rabbul Alameen. How can I do these things? He said, my servant was hungry. My servant was thirsty. My servant was ill. Had you gone to be with them, you would have found me there. There's connections here. There's relations here. And so what these narrations are indicating to us is that the immediate interaction is between person A and B. But fundamentally, how I treat you is going to also then impact how it is that I relate to the divine. Does that make sense? And so why we want to get a hold of this is because we want to feel empowerment and strength through our relationship with Allah. And to recognize that the default that Allah has said, there's literal hadith that says, Allah has written above his throne that his mercy exceeds his wrath. It's a rule he imposes on himself. So the dynamic that I have capacity to influence in my relationship with Allah is just the presence of myself that I bring to that relationship. And this is not a good or bad type conversation. You don't want to think about it in that way. But at the juncture of life that we find ourselves in, having regular modes of inventorying what's going on with me so that I'm not giving myself the facade of healing or giving myself pursuits of complacency, but I want to have real contentment. I want to feel good and balanced all of the time. And so we become a product of a lot of different things, but there's fundamental relationships that we have that have elements that start off in a certain way, and then they just grow and grow and grow, and they start to build literally within us things that overshadow our prism and perspective. You don't want to carry that kind of heaviness inside of you. You don't want to have that kind of hurt. You have people that are not reciprocating. You still determine for yourself, though, how you relate to others with healthy boundaries. But fundamentally, you can have a boundary that is setting for you a sense of self rooted in self-care, or you can have a boundary that has now built itself up as a wall that has you constantly on the defensive. Stress is not a bad thing to have. Your stress is going to give you a sense of adrenaline that's going to tell you, hey, the bear is about to attack me. I better run. But what if you felt that feeling the majority of your wakeful hours? And your body has now been overwhelmed for years because the default mode of existence is one of just stress that stems from irreconciled pain, bitterness, unending resentment, damaged relationships, And so the idea of rebuilding is not rooted in this notion that, again, Shaitan has victory over you, that says you're a bad person because you hurt. You don't want to think about it in that way. But you want to think primarily for the sake of your own inside that you don't have to carry this pain. It's not an easy fix. It's not just something that you pray your pain away. You're not a light switch that you turn on and off and says, now I'm happy, now I'm sad. But you got to be able to go through places of recognition. It's a process. The person in the hadith does this so often and so much that it's something that bears now regularity. It's going at the end of the day and engaging. We have a spiritual practice in our tradition that is essentially rooted in this, that is just called muhasaba. In it is the word hisab or hasib, right? Which means to take account, right? This is a self-inventory. You build into your day, your week. You can do it with a counselor. You can do it with a therapist. You can come sit in my office and yell and scream and whatever else, but you're letting things out as a mode of saying, what actually is existing in my heart? Somebody sits with me and they say to me that I'm surprised at my reaction based off of what is going on with me as I speak about these things. That's what emotional intelligence is. You have an openness that there's still things that you can learn about yourself. If I was to ask each of you to take a moment and to just say, like, what do you really have in your heart right now? What's going on in there? It creates agitation, creates anxiety, creates stress, creates frustration. Who are people in your life that you have difficulty with? And it goes in the other direction also as a mode of healing, right? So we could start this conversation off, and I'm not going to make you do this, but I could tell each of you to pull out your phone and text somebody that you care about and just say to them, thank you for being in my life. That I love you. I care about you. Many of you would likely get a response from somebody that would be like, are you okay? Like, are you sick? Right? Something happened to you? Because it's not the norm where you express that sense of appreciation towards somebody. If your heart has overt levels of just living through thoughts of bad relationships again and again and again, and it's not experiencing you express recognition of positive relationships ever, then it becomes abnormal. Why is it abnormal to tell somebody you care about them? Right? Now you experience this, and there's an imbalance. That over here, the negativity is quite prevalent to the point that the positivity is so diminished in its impact, but it's so rare to experience also. Because if it's rare for you to express, then it's also rare for the person that you're not expressing it to hear it coming from you. Then they don't get to hear that you care about them, right? We see each other. How many times in a week do you and I see each other?
Maybe 14, 20.
We don't see each other 20 times a week. No, I don't know what you're doing. Every time you and I see each other, what do you say to me?
Or your outfit.
Yeah. Just really nice things. Say, it's so nice to see you. I like to see you too. And a simple interaction can create a different sense of belonging. Doesn't have to be so overt. Doesn't have to be drawn out. I can't remember a time that you and I have seen each other where I haven't smiled. And That's remarkable. And you want to think, is that like a hard thing to do? No. But just at some point or the other, that just started happening. And you play a role in choosing that for yourself. Are you going to walk around and let what defines? Yeah, it's not easy, but if you can acknowledge, I got a lot of clutter inside. And we figure out strategies to remove the clutter, part of which is a proactive mode of deliberately engaging in what will render now a sense of upliftment and positivity that doesn't have me exist in my own head saying, I hate the way that I am right now. I don't like myself. And it's one of the worst consequences of carrying those things inside of you. You start to dislike you. You have difficulty in loving you. And then you put all kinds of things out, helter-skelter, to all kinds of random people. Because the defining quality for yourself has to be affirmation that I need these people to know this about me, not because I need to be able to understand if they can stand me knowing all of what I carry, but for me to still feel validation that they know this about me. And if they can stand being in my company, then maybe I'm not as bad as I think that I am. You're not a bad person. It's not okay that people mistreat you. Your resentment can be valid. But when you live in that for so long and you're constantly talking within yourself, you're not just rebuilding relationships with others, but you also have to start to rebuild certain relationships with parts of you that you've been in negligence of. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? Some of you likely have had conversations with people that you're considering to get married to, significant others. Some of you might be on the receiving end of this. The number of people who I've spoken to who say to me, I'm going to go meet this guy. I'm going to go meet this girl. Do you think I should tell them this about me? This really heavy thing that I have in my life. It's the first time we're meeting, and I just need them to know. I don't know the strategy there. It's not like a cookie cutter type answer. Each one of you is unique. Your hearts are precious. You do not live in a virtual world that every lecture you hear on YouTube is applicable to you. You need one-on-one interaction to be able to speak to people that make sense, which is not going to always be friends and family. Sometimes people will have no idea what to do with the words you're throwing at them. That doesn't mean they care about you less. They just don't know what to do, which is fine. Better that they don't know what to do than pretend like they know what to do and then make it worse. Why are all these people in this place where they're sitting down with somebody for the very first time? And they have to just let out all of this thing. It becomes the defining quality through which I see myself, this irreconciled pain that exists within me. I can't see all of my beauty in its entirety because I've now been defined and identified purely through this prism of hurt that came to me from a relationship that didn't go so well. When you're hearing this, you got to be able to understand that if you have the capacity to patch something up and acknowledge the pain that you have put into somebody else, you don't want to let it just keep going. My 9-year-old daughter was talking to me last night about something. We were going back and forth. I love her so much. And I'm talking to her about just the need to admit when you're doing a mistake. There's nothing wrong with it. And she's telling me, Baba, Kareem doesn't like saying when he's wrong. It's in Medina, baby. Kareem just turned 7 years old. He's still figuring out how to express himself in healthy ways. And he says, other people don't say when they're wrong, Baba. And I said, Jenny, have I ever told you I'm sorry for something I've done to you? And she said, yeah, Baba, you have. And I said, don't we still have fun together? And she said, yeah. And I said, do you see me walking around miserable in the world? She said, no. I took her to a water park on Saturday. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's called Splish Splash in Long Island. It's a lot of fun. My wife did not, she was at work. So my daughter, my son, and my friend Riyad, the four of us went, and it was great. And I'm giving her insights on how you can still enjoy things and that it's not a problem. But my 9-year-old needs to be able to understand also that her father, that she sees speaking in front of various audiences and on television and here and there, still has to be able to apologize to his baby girl when he does something wrong to her. Do you get what I'm saying? So you have to be comfortable with the reality that if you have hurt someone, that you need to play a role in making it whole again. Why is this important? Even if you have to make it egocentric, in our theological understanding, on the day of judgment, before anybody gets to go anywhere for eternal existence, everybody's going to be brought together to be able to make things balanced. You're going to have to stand there with people in that moment, and the things that are not reconciled, they're going to have to get reconciled. That means people owe you things, they're going to be taken into account. May Allah grant us all entrance into his Jannah without any judgment. Before people move, this is what we talk about. Your relationship with God is contingent in ways on your relationship with God's creation. Alhamdulillah. And so you get to a place where you understand it's not Allah who will suddenly take away the ability for you to have what is due to you. He won't make that decision for you. It's not for him to make it on your behalf. Somebody owes you something. They don't take care of it in this world. You're going to stand with them on the day of judgment, and things are going to get taken care of. Similarly, you owe something to somebody. What a foolish reason for me to be delayed, denied entrance into paradise because I can't say sorry to my daughter. Can you imagine that? So if you have that capacity to mend what makes sense to mend, you want to mend it. What we want to focus on is mostly the other end of it, where I'm carrying the pain inside. I'm carrying the hurt inside. It's great. You told us this hadith of this companion who goes to bed every night and cleans his heart of holding any ill will towards anyone. Doesn't hold anything against anybody. How do you do that? How does one start to do it? So what I'd like you to do is turn to the person next to you again and answer this question. Somebody came to you and they said, I'm holding a lot inside of me. What are the steps I should take? What would you say to them? And then we'll come back and talk about it a little bit. It makes sense, the prompt? So I came to you, I'm carrying heaviness inside of my heart, a lot of resentment, a lot of pain, a lot of difficulty through damaged relationships. These are not abusive relationships, right? Let's make that clear. It's not an abusive relationship. Entirely different scenario in that sense. Somebody's in a place where things are not going well with someone else. They come to you and they say, what do I do? How do I approach this? What do you say to them? Then we'll come back and discuss.
Yeah, the reported of the
And so I think we were all thinking about that and be upset or about to be hurt. Because your entire parents are going to do that. So, like, changing that spatial, I heard of that. It was like that.
So, you're obviously in the place of life.
I was talking about and was like, I don't know. And she looked at that and he like, and then she realized, because as she did her process, she realized that a lot of them, even if you were someone else, but she was just pretty. So, like, most of the times, like, how we perceive most of those stuff is also based on how we have the peace of mind. And I think, like, that happens to somebody who have really huge amounts of some advice and struggles that you have. And just a lot of stay in my place. Like, I'm constantly thinking. But like, recently I've realized it's like so powerful to like even just like change your thoughts. And so, like, if you like make it an intention, it just like, helps you like show up better. Like, if you're fantastic, like, thinking you're always like, oh, like I said, I'm just the bad man. And like, I just let all the time.
I'm sorry. it took all, like took away so much baggage.
Because you're not like, I think we think that you are instead of just investing. And I think when we don't stops inside of us, that he just stays there. But if we talk about it, I talk about it, and then they will have to make
Okay, so what did we talk about? What were some of the things? I heard everyone talk. Yeah.
I think this is like informed by my like. Of course, I'm very biased in this, but I often, if appropriate with a friend, often advise call your parents and like, or connect with family, and that from that rootedness, I think you're more equipped to tackle other heaviness or other problems that you might be facing. I think family is like a really solid resource if it's available.
Okay. Great. What else? Yeah.
So we talked about a couple of things and in no order, but first asking them in terms of action items, like one, reflect on what is hurting them and like try to define what that emotion is. Is it a specific injustice that happened? Is it, you know, naming the emotion will help you control your actions to it rather than having it control you. Then we talked about unfreezing and really the stress of the emotion, or like stress. The reason why people have stress is because it gives a sense of urgency. So by unfreezing and being able to do something with it, you just feel so much more empowered. And then we talked about contextualizing the problem, you know, really showing that like today isn't forever. And, you know, there's a certain things that could have happened before and certain things that could have happened after. And if your friend feels extremely heavy right now in this moment, just reassuring them that this problem isn't going to be with you forever. And there is hope and there is a solution.
Great. Amazing. What else? Yeah,
I'm not sure, but adding on to the point, you have to like make sure the response is very genuine, because you can't just like for some influencer or something, and if they constantly are saying okay, you can't just have that like those quick cookie cutter responses like you're gonna be okay, but like try to empathize with that individual.
Okay.
And this is a very good issue. If you're on the receiving end, you also have to be able to absorb the situation that other people are going through. It should be able to do as well.
Okay. No plans. So this is like a different person now in the scenario, right? Because there are different roles here. The person that's hurting, the person that's being vented to, and then there's also a third group that's on the person that could be doing the apologies, right? Or could be potentially the one that's helping to heal because I hurt. So a lot of what we were saying before is, you know, this is the person on the receiving end of some of the pain, right? Yeah. What else? Yeah.
So I was talking about how I received the message this morning from a friend that said they're hurting about something and they don't want to talk about it because I know what it feels like to go through something like that. And I thought, like, you know, I always try to think about the wisdom behind whatever happens. I'm pretending to cope with it. And then I never thought, maybe it happened so that when someone else is going through that, I can kind of be that listening here.
Amazing. Anything else?
Just listening to them. And empathizing is there, but
letting them tell what they went through, because sometimes things are pent up, and especially as a male, you don't say much, and if you start saying it, you shut it down. But when you just listen to you from time to time, that itself gets you thinking about, you know, you're thinking there, so maybe another thinking, and maybe making a mountain out of a mole.
Yeah. So let's focus on this person here, right? Because it's really easy sometimes to give wisdom to others, but we have to drink our own tea. We don't really do that so well. So the idea is to be able to create this idea. Someone comes to you and says, what do I do? And now you're telling them to do all this. So you got to tell yourself to do all this, right? So step number one in this is, and you might say, well, that's obvious, is like you have to want it for yourself. And that's not an easy thing to be able to at times really acknowledge. There's not entitlement by any means, but you are fully in a place where you are owed a sense of contentment. You don't have to carry garbage inside of you. You shouldn't have to carry clutter inside of you. Nobody should. But if nobody should, that means also that you should not have to. Right? It doesn't mean the world won't get heavy. We're not talking about an absence of sadness or grief or these kinds of things. Everybody goes through things. These are normal human emotional experiences. That's not what contentment is. In our contentment, Ridha, you can have the experience of being content and simultaneously still be sad. Right? You can have contentment and be angry. You can have contentment, balance inwardly, and be upset, be annoyed, be irritated. But in the sense of what we're trying to do when we're in a space of brokenness, is we have to be in a place where we want to move forward. And you could say, well, who would not want to? There will be people who are in a space where this is the nature of the nafs, right? In our kind of psycho-spiritual model and framework of the self, the nafs does not want you to be courageous or bold. It wants you to be lazy. It wants you to do what's easier, but easier is not always better. And some of it's not going to happen instantaneously, but fundamentally, your first step has to be like, this is what I want. This is my goal and objective. I want healing for myself. I don't want to carry this inside of me. Because then if you really want it, you're not going to put band-aids on it. You're not going to just play games with it. It's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy, but you're going to go through what's necessary to get to a place where that balance is restored strategically, systematically, but in a way that fundamentally says, I know this is what's good for me. I know that this is what is best for me. And I'm going to push myself to get to that place. So that I'm not just trying to get through my days day after day, but I want to start to feel real long-term contentment and balance inside. Does that make sense? So you got to sit down with yourself and you got to like want it. Yeah.
With the story of the person of Jannah who doesn't hold resentment, I think the stuckness that happens when if I would try to take that on myself is like, but I can't feel okay until this other person who wronged me or does this thing changes or like some external action takes place. So I feel like whether it's like a certain level of spiritual development, but there seems to be like a detachment in the sense of like, this is the person I want to be. And I'm like not taking those things personally. So I guess, I don't know if it's coming from like a less evolved place, but my first instinct is like the stuckness is, I can't get there because if I'm feeling resentful, I feel like I can't get past it because I'm like, I need X thing to change. Ultimately, I've done better when I'm detached from that expectation, but I think that's...
It's not going to help you to hate on yourself. You're not a devolved human being. You're clearly like very articulate and intelligent, mashallah. And you don't want to go in with a negative frame that you're already dealing with hell. And then on top of that, you say, plus, like, there's something wrong with me because I'm responding in the way that I'm responding. None of us is the same as anybody else. So just because somebody can put up with something a certain way that I can't put up with in the same way doesn't mean that there's anything problematic with me. We're two entirely different human beings. You know what I mean? So you're in this process of now things coming, and you're going to move forward by being able to just learn about yourself individually. Learning doesn't mean that one is unlearned. It just means that there's still more to know and still to kind of move forward. Do you get what I'm saying? Does that make sense? It's really easy when you deal with like religious platitudes to get to a place where you tell yourself in the midst of difficulty that you're also lacking because you're saying this is difficult, right? The idea of gratitude is to not pretend like the world is amazing always. Some parts of the world are really great, right? But some parts are really heavy. Gratitude is meant to be a vision modifier. It's not that like, here's the obstacle and my gratitude suddenly says there's no obstacle. But what my gratitude enables me to do is to see the obstacle differently than if I was to see it absent of the gratitude. It's a vision modifier, right? And so shaitan is going to get to you, nafs is going to get to you to pull down as much of your own kind of shields as possible. So I'm already thinking about something that induces anxiety, and then I interject another layer of anxiety that the way my mind functions cognitively, when I now start to think about the first thing, I automatically start thinking about the second thing. So I've taken the equivalent of one, and I've now doubled it in heaviness before I even know how to carry either of them. Do you see what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So in this too, after you want it, you gotta figure out a place where all of these things is important, reflecting, naming, etc. But how do you reflect? And it's the key here is how do you reflect? Where do you go to reflect? Where do you go to self-express? Where do you go with regularity to actually contemplate upon things? The default settings that most of us go through are ones that are inwardly inducing chaos because outwardly we're not seeking out stillness, right? Does that make sense? Our tradition embeds 5 moments of clarity in the form of ritual prayer in a day. But our relationship to them individually will vary person to person. You also have, though, a need to have regularity of just spaces where you can sit down to breathe. So I'm not like a, you know, teapot just like simmering over, looking for everything to spill out. But I know how to get myself to a place where I can even begin to think about what it is that I'm going through. The naming of something can be done strategically or it can be done instinctively. And if you do this at a point where you're not in a place of rest, and you tell yourself, you're angry, you're lacking because of your reaction, and then you say it 100 times over and over, then you're going to convince yourself of anything. If you can get to a place where there's stillness and you allow for yourself to maybe not get fully to a place of homeostasis, but as close to it as possible, and then you try to name, right? I'm so angry at my friend. In reality, you were actually just sad. You weren't angry. But now you've told yourself you're angry, and you've also told yourself being angry is terrible. And then everybody around you is like, why are you such an angry person? And it's just anger. And then it's not that you're not coming up with solutions to it, but it's not working because you're not actually framing what the problem is. You're not angry. You're just sad. You get what I'm saying? So the accurate naming of it is the first bucket of emotional intelligence, the ability to accurately name and harness what you're feeling. And what it assumes is that there's constant miscalculations in the namings of things. There's like 31,000 emotions you can feel. If you open up your smartphone and you look through all of the emojis that you have access to. They are so nuanced to be able to express whether you are making those faces or not when you put them into a text message. What they have done is created modes of expression that can identify with such specificity what you are feeling and conveying now to the person that's receiving it. You're not just using the same five words again, happy, sad, angry, whatever, right? But there's like entire lists of these things. You can feel all of those things. Do you get what I mean? But the minute you start telling yourself, I am this, then that's what you believe you are. The minute the people around you start telling you, you are this, then you're going to start thinking about it this way, right? You are a bad son. You are a bad daughter. Allah is not happy with you because you treat your parents like this. You are not a good wife. You are not a good mother. You are not a good sibling. You are not this. You are not that. It builds now core beliefs cognitively that come from the repetitive nature of these conversations, inwardly and outwardly. It's not going to be an easy fix, but you got to disrupt it by finding a place of stillness. Where do you go for that in the course of your routines? That you're able to have places of self-expression. Family can be this, but it also might not be. And not just because family might be the source of the problem, but sometimes you need objective places. Reflection doesn't have to be done in your own kind of individual space. You can take people with you to reflect. You can reflect with somebody. Most people, when they come and sit in my office, they're just taking advantage of a space to self-express. And most of what I say to them is what they said to me, but back to them so they could hear it differently. But they're in a place now where I care about them. I care about all of you, right? I don't hang out with any of you in this room. It's not because I don't want to, right? I would love to hang out with all of you, right? But you have friends that you have different relationships with than I have with you. Right? You have family members who care about you differently. They're in a space where their own anxiety sometimes makes them solution oriented. They don't provide empathetic listening. The second column is important because these are the people you want to be talking to when you're reflecting with them. Not people who are going to listen to respond, but listen to understand. And not people who are going to just give you platitudes, right? Allah likes you to be merciful. What do you want me to do? Are you telling me I'm a bad Muslim? Most of what they're saying to you is because they don't know what to do, but they live in a solution-oriented society that says, I have to say something. It's not even coming from a bad place. They care about you. They don't know how to say, I don't know what to do. So you get to a place now where a therapist can be helpful, a counselor can be helpful, regular spaces where you just go to reflect. You can come and sit in this room that is quite often quiet, and you just look out the window, and you're just taking things in. So much of our tradition relates us to things that are elemental. You make wudu, you're touching water regularly. You don't have wudu, you engage in tayammum. You're literally touching the earth, the dirt. Your prayers are based off of a cyclical pattern of the sun and the moon. We went to Splish Splash on the weekend, and we didn't have any phones the whole day. So you can't go on a water park and water rides with phones, unless you're so addicted to your phone that I saw people holding these like large plastic kind of Flavor Flav type things that just had their, and they were so frustrated. We're in the lazy river. The whole idea is to just enjoy the laziness of it. And there's a man in front of me standing instead of letting the water push him. And he's got this plastic case on his phone. He's like banging it, trying to get it to go. My man, just go lock your phone in the locker, dude. That's all you got to do. We didn't have our phones. And so you can tell the Qibla from the rising and the setting of the sun, right? And it's not hard, right? The sun sets in the west. rises in the east. And so you know after Dhuhr time, the sun is starting to descend. And so if you can find the sun and you can see its trajectory of its descension, then you know that's west. And then if that's west, then here's east. And then here's north. And here's northeast. But you have a relationship to natural elements embedded in your routine day to day. The idea is to be able to relate to the world around you. Does that make sense? It doesn't make sense?
Completely.
What are you left?
Not to climb the mountain, but doesn't know where east is.
Oh, yeah.
No, you taught me north, south, east.
I just taught you north,
south. Bad.
But do you get what I'm saying? So you can't reflect in the places that cause you agitation. And most of the world you spend your day in doesn't care about whether or not you feel good inside. It's going to assess you whether you have children, whether you're married, whether you have a house, how much money you make, how much money you're making for them. It's going to bank on the idea that you're not designing your life so that a corporate vehicle can design your life for you and tell you that your happiness in a consumer-driven society is rooted in purchasing what they're telling you you should buy so you have happiness. So you just take a break sometimes and you relate to the world around you. When we were driving back from Long Island the last 2 days, I went to Long Island on Saturday. And on Sunday, I had to go there for a wedding yesterday for a couple in our community. And we're stuck on the LIE because there's always traffic on the LIE for some reason. And you can't help but just look at the sky. It's unobstructed. And the beauty of the sun piercing against some of these clouds, it's setting. It's just remarkable. And if you believe that God is your creator, then you have to understand the way that Allah created you was to be able to find upliftment through looking at some of these things. When you're devoid of it, and all you're looking at is what's concrete, as opposed to what's natural, is going to have an impact on that diagram of the heart that we had before. You know what I'm saying? You need to visually consume things that are going to render for yourself a place of softness in worthy, right? So how do you reflect? Where do you go to reflect? And reflection can be done in retrospect. It can be done with foresight. It can be done in the moment. Reflection and contemplation is done upon something. It's not rumination. Rumination just creates anxiety. It gives you the facade. It's just creating worry. You see what I mean? You have to answer this question. If the answer to it is that I don't do it, great. That's good. And then you go back to here and you got to say, I want it. So I want you to individually now just take 2 minutes to yourself and try to think out, where can you do this? There's a park that's behind our library here that is situated between two apartment buildings used for grad students and some faculty that we started to do events. It's called Sasaki Park. In the pandemic, we couldn't have food inside. We couldn't do a lot of things inside. We started taking people. And so very begrudgingly, I took people to this quiet place that I used to sit in all by myself. It was always still there. Not so many people. It's surrounded by trees. If you hear anything, you hear kids laughing at a playground close by. But there's nothing that you can feel other than just stillness in this kind of chaotic New York City constant, right? I love New York, don't get me wrong. And there's times where I'll sit in my apartment, just in my bed, and I'll pull out something and start writing on it. A little space like in the couch where I like cushion myself into, doesn't have to be drastic things. You don't need to go and find something that's out in the middle of nowhere that's hard for you to access, right? The answer to this, living in New York City, can't be the place I go to reflect is the Prophet's Mosque in Medina. you're not going to go there every week, right? So it's got to be something that's accessible. It's got to be something that makes sense for you. It doesn't have to be a park, but it's got to be a place that doesn't create anxiety, a place that allows for you to tap into all of your organs of sensory perception so that you're turning inward with everything God has endowed you with to be able to understand what's really going on in my heart. You know what I mean? 2 minutes really quickly. Where do you do that? Just thinking in yourself. And as you're thinking about that, how often do you go to these things? These outlets, these spaces of reflection, these places that uplift you, that you like to be in the company of certain people or the presence of things. Great. So as a metric of assessment, so there's no ambiguity, you should try to go to that place that you just thought about in your head, at least on a weekly basis. At a minimum, once a week, your heart deserves it. If you are not going at all, start with once a week. If you can, you start to build in deliberate modes of reflection a couple of times a week, a few times. Doesn't have to be crazy long. You can start your day in the morning by saying, what am I going to achieve today? 2 to 3 things. It's not have to be grandeur. Today I'm going to build a masjid. Today I'm going to adopt an orphan, right? Today I'm going to do my laundry. I did my laundry over the weekend. And I was talking to somebody on the phone while I was doing my laundry, and they said, you do laundry? I said, I wear clothes just like you. I guess I do my laundry, and I do my kids' laundry, and I do my wife's laundry, because we're not going to walk around in stinky clothes all day. But at the end of the day, folding these clothes and putting them away, alhamdulillah, I got my laundry done today. When I'm reflecting backwards in the evening, did I get done some of the things that I want to get done? Those are some of the things that I want to get done. You see what I mean? Right? It doesn't have to be huge. It can just be something that makes sense where you are. How do you reflect? Where do you go to reflect? I want to be mindful of time. These are things that are really important. I want us to talk about briefly what does not work and what are things we don't want to do. When you're going through your healing process, an outlet is not meant to be an escape from reality, but it's meant to relate to reality in a way that it enhances the reality you find yourself in. Because you can also convince yourself in a way through dissonance that you are wrong about things that you are not wrong about. Just as the person on the other end can tell themselves that they are the one that's in the right, even though that they're undoubtedly wrong. When you're dealing with this kind of pain, you don't want to turn towards outlets that hurt you or hurt somebody else. Most of what we can do that gives us temporary satisfaction, it's going to be just like little chips away at what the anxiety is. I can't tell you the number of people that I've sat with who are just bubbling inwardly with a lot of angst. And every person that they see, they just start telling their business to. Doesn't mean you're doing something wrong, but it's not going to be strategic. You got to pay attention to the signs that your heart, that your body, that your soul is showing you. You don't want to turn towards things that give you temporary satisfaction. So the engagement of things that give you relief for a moment. And sometimes it's heavy. Sometimes it's really hard. there's a woman who was a survivor that we were helping get through various things that she was experiencing. Had a family that forced her into a marriage that was physically abusive of her. Married to a husband that was emotionally negligent and also physically abusive. And I won't go into details to be triggering, but it was heavy. She gave me a diary she wrote in every single day that she was stuck in this marriage, and just reading it was something that was heavy, let alone imagining somebody lived that thing. And when I asked her, how do you cope with it? She said, why would it be wrong for me to drink something or smoke something that causes me to lose awareness when every wakeful moment of my life is hell? Now, I didn't say to her, because I'm supposed to be in this box, oh my God, that's haram. What are you talking about? Because that's not where she's at. Do you get what I mean? But fundamentally, in the long term of the conversation, it's not going to be helpful to her to have that as an outlet, because it's going to just be temporary. It's not dealing with what's there. It's just having you escape from it. You get what I mean? So when you're dealing with this pain, you don't want to turn towards things. Pornography, substances, these are things that outwardly we can say are just very, very easily discerned, right? But you can turn that into being in a place where that's just watching TV for hours, eating in ways that don't make sense, sleeping excessively, being in a place where you turn towards shopping, gossiping, backbiting. You can even build resentment as an outlet that gives it more weight. Because when you display resentment towards someone and you say to them, you're wrong in treating me in this way, it can give you a sense of strength, right? Somebody talks to you poorly and you put them in their place and you say, you should not talk to me like this. And you got the adrenaline going, saying I'm standing up for myself. You can want to feel that so badly that you relive that moment again and again as a way to energize yourself. And then it's sticking with you in an unhealthy way. Do you get what I mean? And so these outlets have to be things that get you to a place of long-term balance, not just temporary satisfaction. There's got to be a strategy to it. And I'll give you an example anecdotally that I've shared with some of us in different halakas before individually. And then I'm going to wrap up for today because I want to give people a chance to make wudu if they want. Maghrib comes in at like 7:55. The building closes at 8. So what the hope is that we're just going to stand and pray. 7:55, pray Maghrib together, short surahs, and we'll leave after the Maghrib, right? So we'll wrap up in a few minutes so anybody can get ready. We'll call the Iqama right at 7:55 and we'll pray and everyone gets out of the building on time. The deal?
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't get anyone waiting for us for too long. In the pandemic, I was in the midst of like a lot of different things in our community. You know, we serve 10,000 people here, alhamdulillah. And we become one of the key Muslim institutions in the city as a major house of worship, whether that makes sense or not. To me, it doesn't, because we're university-based. But we get pulled into all kinds of things, especially now when it comes to assisting people in need. So before, there were stimulus checks getting issued or being talked about right in the first week of the pandemic. This community, you all, mashallah, raised in 3 days about $800,000 to issue micro cash grants to individuals who are in need. Rent evictions, lost their jobs, etc. You then raised even more money for funeral assistance, right? 30,000 people died in New York City. And in our community, in the first few weeks, we knew of 100 people who either passed away or lost loved ones before we stopped counting, let alone how many people were getting sick. You had abusers now stuck at home with their with survivors sick at home with their abusers. People were in places where it was just very difficult. And so our staff is taking a lot of this in. I was carrying a lot of people's trauma. I got to a place where my weight went really high. I was heavier than I've ever been. I herniated two discs in my neck. I was going through random sicknesses. At one point, this whole part of my body broke out into hives. The herniated discs had this part of my body swelled up. I had to relearn how to use my left hand. And they were testing me for various things. They said, maybe you have liver cancer, maybe you have skin cancer. Alhamdulillah, it all cleared up. But probably a year into it, my wife said to me, you need to just kind of get away for a little bit. And so I was going to go with some of my friends to Lake George. And she took our kids to her parents' house in Michigan. And the day that they left, I was supposed to leave the next day. And I found out after they left that my trip was canceled because COVID rates went up in Lake George. So I'm in my house by myself, my apartment. And I haven't been alone in my apartment for the entirety of the pandemic. My son is now 7. My daughter's going to turn 10 in December. So they were a few years younger at the onset of this. And they're constantly running around. There's always noise. There's never like a place of just being alone. And now it's just silence. And I start to miss them. And as I'm missing them, which is not a bad thing, my mind now starts to go back to other memories. When you experience heavy things, those feelings innately attach themselves to memory. And in my head, I start remembering other times when I felt alone. And I start remembering fights I had with my wife when we first got married. This is our 11th year of marriage, alhamdulillah. I'm thinking back to things from like 8 years ago, 9 years ago. She calls me that night from Michigan. And as she's talking, I'm not hearing a word she's saying. But just as her voice is going through my head, all of my thoughts are just tell her about that fight and say that thing. And I'm not listening to a word. And in my heart, I'm saying, man, you better not say anything because you know it's going to mess things up and she's not going to hear any of it. And it's going to make her trip worse. And you're going to sit here and you're going to feel more anxious because you are scared of your wife. And you're going to worry what she's going to come back and say to you. So I didn't say a word. And the conversation lasted literally 2 minutes. And then I hung up the phone. I ordered a burger from Tallgrass on 11th Street, and First Avenue, near my apartment. I live on 23rd and 3rd. I ordered a crepe from Creperie over here on McDougal, if you've ever been to it. And I got the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup Crepe. Stuffed with Reese's and peanut butter and ice cream and bananas. Amazing. I ordered that for that night. I turned on a movie to watch that I knew would make me laugh. And I turned off all my electronics. And then the next day, my friend and I went to the Poconos. He skied. I couldn't because of my neck injury. So I just slept in the hotel all day. That night when he came back, we got some takeout from a sushi place. We then watched like a bunch of Harry Potter movies that were playing on TV. The next morning, we came back to the city. We found a diner that let us eat indoors against regulations. We were eating there with everybody else. They came back, got some more rest. 5 days passed until I was in a place that was more stable. And then after 5 days, I then looked back to name what I was feeling, to understand what was going on. If in the moment I tried to do all of it, I would have misnamed. I would have not accurately understood. I would have blamed everything on her, said she's the problem. And then I just keep telling myself. And then we go back and forth, passing pain to each other. And then it would just create more hurt in the long term. So the outlet is rooted in reality because I wasn't eating those things or watching that stuff as an escape. But I knew I had to get to a place because it wasn't even in a vacuum. The whole year before it was dealing with all kinds of things in the pandemic. And it's culminated to this place. All of you is attached to the rest of you. You don't have good work-life balance. You don't have good self-care strategies. You don't have ways to deal with life. And then life pushes you down. It's going to hurt 1,000 times over. Inshallah, that never happens to any of you. But you have to start building strategy into it. You get what I'm saying? As you get older, it's a lot different. My kids literally will fight with each other. And they will fight with other people on the parks that they go to. And 5 minutes later, they're all playing together again. Their emotional recovery time is very different than when you get older and the bitterness seeps in and all this other stuff seeps in. You see what I mean? You, in your first reflection setting, when you go sit in that place, pull out a notebook and say, what are my outlets? How do I take care of my heart? Not temporary satisfaction. What am I doing with regularity? I'm turning 40 this year. Alhamdulillah. I wake up every day excited about what the day is going to bring. I also wake up every day after Fajr. I pray Fajr, and you should pray Fajr. Not because you're throwing your back against a wall in defense, but it will give you metaphysical benefits to your heart. I go at that time to the gym for about 1.5 hours. I'll finish at the gym. I'll take a shower. I'll read Quran in the morning, about 1/4 to 1/2 juz. Because I exercised, I'll make sure then I eat something because my body needs it in response to that. I'll help get my kids ready for school, breakfast, drop them off to camp or school, whatever, get work done. Make sure in the course of my week, regardless, I took my kids to the water park, but also went with a friend of mine who I've known for 20 years so that on a regular basis, I'm building deeper relationships with people. All of those things fit into your outlets. You control you in a broken relationship, not the other person. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? Okay.
We hope you enjoyed our podcast. If you're inspired by the work that we're doing at the IC and want to help keep it going, subscribe to our podcasts, follow us on social media, donate to help support us at icnyu.org, and most importantly, keep us in your continued du'as. Until next time, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.